with Mark 14, verses 50 through 52. And they all, again, the pronoun here is undefined, but it's the 11, left him and ran for their life. They all abandoned him, really, would be better here, and ran for their lives. And a young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen garment over his unclothed body. Again, he could have been wearing underwear. He may have been fully naked under it. We don't really know. And somebody grabs him. The they here would be somebody in the arrest party. And I say they, probably some single person grabbed him, tried to get him. But it's attributed to the whole arrest party. Not every one of them grabbed him, certainly. But he pulled free. Actually, he abandoned. And this is what's funny. The disciples abandoned him and fled. And this word is similar. He abandoned the garment. And so he's willing to leave everything behind in order to save his life, as they all are. And Jesus, again, had warned them. So we left off here with point 7. Again, whatever fears they had on the way to Jerusalem had not been calmed, and now they know that their fears are very well founded. Mark's statement here in verse 50 is not so much one of condemnation as it is a simple statement of the facts of the matter. It's not as though he's going out of his way to condemn the disciples. He's just stating, pretty matter-of-factly, that this is what happened. They all abandon him and they all flee. And 9, while Luke and John do not mention the fulfillment of Jesus' earlier citation of the prophecy in Zechariah, Matthew uses almost identical language to describe their abandonment of Jesus and their subsequent flight. The quote there from Zechariah is recorded for us. It's that, "I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered." And then that's in Mark 14:27. And so then in Matthew, the primary difference is in the word order. Matthew uses the more standard Greek sentence construction, which involves the nominative, that's the subject normally, followed by the aorist participle, having abandoned, then the accusative, the direct object, abandoned him, and then the final verb. So in Matthew 26:56, you've got much more of the normal Greek sentence word order. Then all the disciples left him and fled. Well, the difference in Mark's account is the force of it. The nominative is placed at the end of the sentence, which provides, again, more of a tone of finality and totality. They fled, all of them. And that's it, all of them fled. And it's designed to sort of be more dramatic in that sense, to express that not one of them bothered staying behind to see what would happen. Now, some may have not fled as far as others, but they all fled. They all did run for their lives, including Peter, of course. Well, 12, the verb used to describe their first action in verse 50 is aphiemi, which generally means to cause someone or something to experience a separation. Again, the separation can be physical, as in the time-space continuum. You're moving away from something. Or it has other metaphorical usages like divorce and forgiveness of sins. 13, while it is used in a number of ways in the New Testament, the context here indicates that it means to leave someone behind. It has the force of abandoning Jesus. And then 14, once they began to place some distance between themselves and Jesus, they immediately resorted to flight in order to ensure their own safety. And 15, in spite of Jesus' words to the arresting party. Now, only John records these words that Jesus had basically looked out up until the very end. And he prays about this in actually chapter 17 when he says, "I have not lost any of them. I kept all of them. These men are safe. You gave them to me, and I've kept them safe just as I was supposed to do." That's his job as the authority, as the shepherd. And then in John 18, 8 and 9, they come and seek him. He asks them, "Who are you looking for?" And they say, "Jesus the Nazarene." And Jesus said, "I told you that I'm him. So if you seek me, let these go their way. To fulfill the word which he had spoke, of those whom you have given me, I lost not one." So in spite of his words to the arresting party, the disciples were convinced that they were in grave danger. Is there any other kind? Literally ran for their lives. And 16, in verse 51, we are introduced to the unnamed young man, who is clearly not associated with the 11 apostles. However, he is apparently close enough to Jesus physically to be identified with him. He got, in this case, we might say, a little too close to the action. He got in the middle of it. Again, you talk about the wrong place at the wrong time. This guy's in. He ends up where he doesn't want to be. In 17, the Greek noun, neoniskos, young man, originally referred to a man in the prime of life, somewhere between the ages of 24 and 40. So he could have been older, but again, sort of the implication when we see this, I mean, if he is in his 20s, which he might be, he may have actually been a homeowner there. Again, we don't know. But I think the implication is he didn't follow him far. He wasn't dressed for it. So that he'd come out sort of on the spur of the moment type situation. In 18, he is further identified by the indefinite pronoun tis, someone or a certain one, which suggests that who he was is not actually important to Mark. In 19, the use of the verb sunako lutheo indicates that he was in the immediate vicinity of Jesus. But again, the reader is not told how or when he arrived in the garden. How long he followed, we're not told. It's an imperfect. But again, he could have been following for 60 seconds. He could have been following for 10 minutes. If he was following for 10 minutes, he probably followed from Jerusalem. But again, we don't have enough to say definitively. And 20, in this particular context, it may mean nothing more than the fact that he followed Jesus out of some sense of curiosity. However, it may also mean that he was a sympathizer with Jesus. Again, the language is vague, and we're not given more information here. And some of these verses, I believe, are fully in here to test the exegete. Will he stick with what's there? Will he not abandon this and run off with creative explanations that might be good for sermonizing or whatever else, but really don't stick with the text? And so you have to say, well, the text only tells us so much. And so obviously one of the things we would take away from this is God doesn't have us necessarily knowing every little aspect of his plan. But we know what we need to know. And here we know enough to know that there was a guy there. And again, why this is recorded in Mark, again, maybe he is including himself anonymously. But none of the other authors mentioned it, and they were all there. Luke wasn't, but Matthew and John were certainly there. So, again, we're not really told. That kind of language, akolutheo, can mean to follow as a disciple. But there's no indication he had been following as a disciple, so I would take it in a strictly physical sense here. In 21, an important question is where the young man came from in the first place. His attire suggests that this was not something he had planned on doing, but that he did hurriedly on the spur of the moment. The verb periballo, to cast around, is used regularly of putting on clothing. The middle voice, as it would be with clothing, you both do it and participate in the results of it, indicates that he had dressed himself in a cloth garment of some sort and was apparently wearing only that. In 23, the noun sindone generally refers to an article made of cloth. It is only used to describe his clothing and the linen in which the body of Jesus was wrapped after his death. That we see both Matthew and Mark. You've got two parallels there. Joseph of Arimathea uses a linen garment. Now, Joseph was a more well-to-do person, so this could suggest that the person was well-to-do. But that doesn't, you know, you can't say that because, I mean, sometimes, you know, a poor person might invest in a good suit of clothes. They might have a fine garment of some sort, even though the rest of their clothes would reflect their lower status. So, again, we can't say for certain. You can't say, oh, well, since Joseph was rich, this guy must have been rich. No, not necessarily. He might have just had a particularly nice garment that he liked. So the consensus is that this was something on the order of a nightshirt, a loose-fitting garment that had been thrown on without much thought. In 25, some have indicated the fact that the garment was made of linen indicated that the man was of some means, since the lower classes generally had woolen garments. However, the term is not that precise, and there is another family of words that are used to describe more costly garments. You see that, for instance, in Luke 16:19. In the story of the rich man and Lazarus, the rich man had nice clothes. Well, that would not be unusual. You could imagine that's something that rich people will invest in, is nice, finer clothes. But again, that doesn't mean that a poorer person would never buy a nice set of clothes or have a garment that was particularly nice. They could. Now, the rich man, there was a rich man, and he habitually dressed in purple and fine linen. joyously living in splendor every day. But he's an unbeliever. So this is, again, the lot of life. There are many prosperous unbelievers out there who do very well, do not read anything into the fact, oh, God's blessed them. Not necessarily. I mean, God has blessed them in a general sense in that he allows them to accumulate things or get to a certain point in society. But is he actively blessing them under his directive will? Probably not. Like he would bless a believer. Certainly not. And then it's used in Revelation 18:12 to describe the prosperity of the United States in the last days. Prophetic Babylon. And it describes what we trade in. And we trade in many expensive items that you can get. Now, one of the things I did notice, strangely enough, up there, was like beer and hard liquor was also more expensive. But wine was about the same price or cheaper. And I can only attribute that to, you know, again, imports and all of that. If they're coming from Australia, it costs no more to ship it to Alaska than it does to ship it to the lower 48. Because they probably go up direct. Same with French wines. But wines were actually about the same price. Or some, in some cases, I found wines that were even cheaper up there. But I didn't have any more room in my suitcase. So what could I do? Verse 12, the merchants of the earth, of course, when the U.S. goes down, weep and mourn over her. No more iPads, none of this stuff being sold. Nothing from Korea, Taiwan, all this stuff comes in from India, the Philippines, all this stuff. Nobody's buying it anymore. There's no more people to buy it. And because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver, precious stones, pearls, and fine linen. And that's a different term. So the fact that this was a linen garment doesn't even mean that it was expensive linen garment. There's another family of words that would describe that. Well, 26, the next phrase, epigumnu, which means over his nakedness, or over his poorly clothed body, would tend to indicate that he was completely naked underneath the garment. Still, some suggest that he had on a loincloth, since the term gumnos can also mean barely clothed or poorly clothed. For instance, it's used in John 21:7. And the Jews viewed nakedness as an inappropriate state, as has been really true since the time of the Garden of Eden. There was only really one time when the word nakedness is used in a good context. And that's with Adam and Eve in the context of husband and wife. And that's prior to the fall. After that, nakedness in the scripture has a bad connotation. And consistently has a bad one. But here in John 21:7, where Jesus is out, or Peter and the disciples are out fishing, and Jesus calls to them from the shore, and he tells them, okay, have you fished all night? Do you have any fish? No. This is called God not blessing you on a fishing trip. And he said, well, cast your net on the right side and you'll find a catch. And they cast and they couldn't haul it in. Therefore, the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. So when Peter heard that it was the Lord, he had put on his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work. And that doesn't mean he was totally naked. I mean, you know, sailors don't tend to do that. Don't get a lot of that on a fishing boat, thank goodness. You know, well, let's all strip naked and fish. And that's not really the way you do it. So Peter had on an undergarment of some sort. We're just not told what it was. But it's the same word. He said he was stripped for work. And he threw himself into the sea. So he throws on his robe, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But this is the impetuous and stupid nature of Peter. I mean, he throws on this heavy garment and jumps into the water. Why didn't you just jump in without it? You could have got there. What did you think? They were going to leave the boat out there and, you know, never get your garment back. So, but anyway, that was the way he did it. And James uses it in the sense of poorly clothed in James 2:15. And which in that context, again, you have to translate this not as naked. If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, it doesn't mean they're running around naked. And I really didn't run around naked for many days. That was a joke. It was just that one time. But I didn't really, it wasn't like I just stuck my head around the door. They could see nothing but my head. So if you had some weird idea, don't let that get you. So, and in need of daily food. And it doesn't mean they don't have any food. It could mean they don't have any, but they're poorly fed. They have a diet that's lacking. And you tell them, be in peace. Go in peace. Yeah, here you go. I'm for you. And he just says, talk is cheap. A lot of people talk a good fight in the angelic conflict. But God's going to put their feet to the fire, and we'll see who lives it out. And that will get into the nature of their positive volition and their willingness to make the applications, even the hard ones. Well, 27, in any case, the young man gets caught up in the events as they unfold. And it's close enough to the arrest party that they grab him at the same time that they grab Jesus. And then 28, the reader is not told why they would seek to arrest this young man with Jesus, since the arrest party is there for Jesus and not for anyone else. And again, there's no indication that they attempted to grab any of the other 11. But of course, by the time they grab this young man, the 11 have fled. So they're gone. Or at least, you know, it's disappearing into the night, we might say. But there was no indication that they ever tried to grab any of them. And this gets into a question that you'll have, and you can ponder on this as we approach this issue with Peter. Were any of the disciples in danger that night? And it doesn't appear that they were. John doesn't appear to be too fearful of walking into the high priest's courtyard. There you go. Into the courtyard of the high priest. John doesn't appear to be scared. And certainly, I mean, he knew people in there, sure. But he also is identified with Jesus just like Peter is. He's from Galilee just like Peter is. And so why wasn't he scared, and why was Peter so scared? Were the disciples in any danger that night, or did they just think they were in danger? And it appears to me they weren't in danger, but they thought they were in danger. So this explains their behavior. Whether they were in danger or not is really irrelevant. If you think you're in danger, then you're in danger. I mean, you think you are anyway. That doesn't mean you actually are. Again, we're not told why, how this works exactly. In some cases, you have to kind of think about it and say, well, And it appears that no one attempted to arrest Peter even when they knew who he was in the courtyard of the high priest. They figured out this man was with Jesus. But he appears free to run out when he finally does. He appears free to abandon the place and leave. So, 29 here. However, while Jesus is willing to meet his fate and surrender himself to the arrest party, the young man is not so inclined. This is seen in the next verse, which is introduced by the mild adversative conjunction, but, duh. That's verse 52. But he pulled free of the linen to express, again, an adversative situation. Rather than a continuative situation you would use like with Kai. 30, he wriggles free from the garment. Again, suggesting it was probably somewhat loose-fitting and abandons it to run for his life just as the apostles had. So again, why would you need to introduce this young man as a figure for the apostles? We've just seen the apostles literally. You don't need a figure for them. Why would he do this? Again, so you have to, you know, these are questions you can think about. And maybe, again, Mark may have been writing himself in anonymously. But we don't know for certain. And again, why did not Matthew or Luke, John include this? Because they were eyewitnesses of this as well. Well, 31, Mark uses the same verb to describe his actions that he had used to describe those of the apostles in verse 50. The verb phugo means to seek safety from danger by avoiding it or by running away from it. And 32, while there are many potential explanations as to the young man's identity and several explanations about how he came to be in Gethsemane in the first place, none can be proven conclusively. Mark is most often suggested. This is the one you'll see most of the time if you do any reading on this. And again, I do not encourage you to spend much time reading commentaries, because the fact is, you may read a statement that's really good and true, and then you think, oh, this guy's good, and then he'll have statements down the line that are not good and not correct. The commentary reading you can leave to me. Bible study you can do on your own. Now, I don't have any problem with people reading and studying the Bible. Of course, we'd encourage you to do that. But again, the commentaries and getting into the technical aspect of it, and even some of the guys, like there's this guy named Fruchtenbaum, who's a Jewish believer. And he has got a lot of eisegetics in his stuff because he's very familiar with Judaism. He came out of it. And he'll have some statements that are right on, like he was very dogmatic and emphatic, and I didn't know this till after the fact. Bill pointed it out to me. that he definitively said, whatever the fig tree is, it is not national Israel. He said, there's no way it's national Israel. And he was very dogmatic about that. And so, but then you'll read other statements and he'll fall all over himself. Just as many interpreters will. They don't have, in many cases, the doctrinal grid which protects them. Or in some cases, not in his case, he certainly has the Hebrew, but he probably does not have the Greek to make these, to clear certain things up grammatically that could be cleared up from the languages. So again, if you read all of this, many are offered, but other suggestions have included James, John, and even Lazarus. But now Lazarus lived in Bethany. What's the likelihood of Lazarus being in Gethsemane at 2 a.m.? Poorly dressed, he would have had to make the journey over the mountain. So some of them you can think through and think, well, no, that doesn't fit. Because it said he had been following Jesus. And again, we're not told how long. But if Lazarus showed up, he wouldn't have been following Jesus. He would have showed up from the other side, coming in the other direction. So some, again, you can eliminate. B, those that believe it to be Mark have suggested that the Last Supper was at his parents' house in Jerusalem. And that he had followed Jesus and the apostles when they left the house. Again, if he's a young man in his 20s, why wouldn't he put on some clothes? Even if he's going to follow. It's not like Jesus and the apostles are running out, you know, let's do a sprint. And, you know, we got up there, as I don't know if I told you or not, but I asked Bill, you know, can you outrun a bear? And he said, I don't need to. I just need to be able to outrun you. So talk about throwing under the bus. Unfortunately, we didn't have to flee in. And you don't really have to run from a moose, although there's not much point, really. They can cover a lot of ground real fast. And while they can't see you to kill you, they'll stomp you to death. Is the way they die up there from moose attacks. They stomp you to death. They use their hooves as weapons. You'd think they'd use those big horns, the antlers, but no. They'll do that with other mooses. So some say it was John Mark, again, possibly, because his parents were wealthy. And they suggest also that this upper room that they met in for the Last Supper is also the upper room they met in later in Acts. But I think I'll have to go back and look at my Acts notes because I did that so long ago to see if there's any conclusive proof there. I don't think that there was, as I remember. Well, see, another suggestion is that Judas originally took the arrest party to the house since that is where he believed he would find Jesus. Okay, that I don't have any trouble with. That, in fact, makes sense to me that he would have done that because that's the last place he knew of their whereabouts. And then D, once Mark became aware of this fact, likely being awakened from sleep, he quickly threw on the closest garment and went to warn Jesus. Or perhaps, again, you know, if he wasn't awakened suddenly and didn't do this, well, again, why is it not better thought out if he's a rich kid in Jerusalem, in his parents' house? It would make more sense that, unless this was done, again, very hurriedly, that he wouldn't stop and think about it. Well, E, since Judas knew Mark was a sympathizer, he alerted the temple police to his identity, and they sought to arrest him. But again, why wouldn't he have alerted him to the other 11? This poses some questions. Well, why didn't Jesus tell him who the other 11 were? And why didn't they were much closer followers of Jesus than Mark would have been at that time, if indeed it even was Mark. Again, this can't be proven. But even if it was Mark, weren't the other 11 much closer followers of Jesus and way more identified with him? And yeah, they were. Because when we get in, as you look ahead later in Mark, when Peter gets into his deal, that's what they challenge him with. You were with him. You were with him. You're one of his disciples. And so they would not have known that about Mark, even if he was a sympathizer. So why grab him? Again, maybe other than maybe Judas said something. But again, you're grabbing at straws. You're trying to explain things that the Bible doesn't explain. Well, F, others have suggested that this unidentified young man lived in the vicinity of Gethsemane, was awakened by the noise of the arrest party, and had simply come outside to investigate. And that's as good of an explanation as any, really. That, to me, very much fulfills what we have here. That he's not dressed, he hasn't planned for this. And so he just goes out, and happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, 33, while these may be possible scenarios, the text is inconclusive. And Mark does not choose to provide any further information to clarify the event. And again, none of the other Gospels record it, so there's no more way you can check this out, really. And it's not alluded to. And so again, I think this is designed to check the intellectual honesty of interpreters. There are verses like that, I'm convinced. To where God the Holy Spirit will say, will you stick with the text, or are you going to get creative here? And what you last thing you need is a creative exegete, especially one with an overactive imagination. They can come up with some weird ideas out of some of the most basic texts. And you really have to watch for that as a pastor and even believers as you're listening. You have to say, well, does he go way beyond what the text says here? And I've seen pastors get up and dogmatically rail on a text and this means this and blah, 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 and there's no other way. And I'm looking at it thinking, I could offer several explanations. And if I'm sitting out there and I can think through it, well, then that tells me he's gone too far with this. He's gone beyond what the text allows. And that's a danger. That's a test, again, of your intellectual honesty. Will you stick with what's here rather than getting creative? Well, 34, however, the fact that this incident is recorded by Mark does demonstrate certain things about those that followed Jesus. Whether they were apostles, those that followed less closely, or even those that were there by accident. And that could have very well been it. This guy could have just been there by accident, as it were. I mean, we recognize in God's plan there are no accidents, but we recognize that he didn't plan all this, and he wasn't a follower in that sense. There's nothing that says he was a close follower of Jesus. He followed with him, should be, I think, again, understood in its strictly literal sense. He just followed him for a brief period, however long it was. Again, which might mean he came from Jerusalem, or he came, you know, he heard the party and went out, or heard Jesus and the disciples maybe even approaching. Before the arrest party got there, he could have heard Jesus and the disciples, because they were clearly talking on the way into Gethsemane, because again, a lot of that narrative, the speeches and all are recorded in John. Well, 35, at the critical moment, this is the important thing to walk away from all this, everybody abandoned him. At the critical moment, they all run. Which serves to underscore the complete and utter failure of those that claim to support him. They all left him to face his destiny without any human support. And they hadn't been supportive there, as we know from the previous chidings of Jesus. They hadn't been supportive in the garden either. And now they're not supportive either. In fact, this would be discouraging, you would think, if you're the spiritual leader and you suddenly are faced with this test of being arrested and all the disciples abandon you and run off. And say, well, you know, let him face it himself. We're not going to get caught up in this. We can't do anything, or whatever they thought. Well, 36, the reader should be prepared for this, since Jesus had predicted they would all abandon him. That's the passage there out of Zechariah. And none of them offered any support during the critical time when he was wrestling with his fate. We had just seen all that, and that they were all sleeping. They all fell asleep. None of them were praying. None of them encouraged him. None of them did anything. And this has to be discouraging. I mean, if you put yourself in Jesus' place, and you're there, and you're alone, and you've made all these sacrifices for these people, and at the critical moment when you need them, they abandon you. Well, this is a part of our suffering for Christ. This can happen in your Christian life. So, again, while we can rely on people, and you have the support and fellowship of the local church, if people let you down, don't let it bother you. Because that, just chalk it up to this happens in the angelic conflict. Now, these are some of the sufferings of Christ that you can enter into. To have somebody abandon you that maybe you've only done good to, that you've done right by them, and then they abandon you. Well, this is what Jesus faced, and there's no indication we won't face these things. And in fact, have. Well, 37, these are men who had left everything, in their estimation at least, to follow Jesus as disciples. Now, this unidentified young man personifies the reality that they are willing to leave everything to avoid following Jesus. Mark 10:28, Peter had made this assertion. And again, it has to be taken in context. Clearly, they didn't leave everything. We know they saw their families from time to time. They went back home from time to time. They maintained certain relationships. Now, they'd left their jobs as fishermen to follow Jesus. Matthew had left his job as a tax collector. But this has to be understood in context and not in that they had abandoned everything totally to leave Jesus. But they had abandoned enough that Peter could make this statement, and Jesus didn't contradict him. So in verse 10:28, Peter began to say to him, Behold, we have left everything and have followed you. Essentially, what's in it for us? And this is a legitimate question for a believer to ask. Some people I've heard, they don't believe this is a legitimate question to ask. Well, Jesus didn't turn around and say, well, you selfish guy, you. He answered it. He said, yeah, there's something in it for you. And there's something in it for every believer. But the question is, are you willing to pay the price to get God's best? That's the deal. Are you willing to abandon everything and follow where you're supposed to follow? Not generate your own agenda and follow that, but to follow the agenda, the race that's being set before you by God. Under His directive will. Well, 38, the fact that Mark mentions the young man's nudity twice is designed to emphasize the shame of their actions. And this is, the shamefulness of... And again, this personifies or in some ways parallels exactly what the disciples have done. What they do is shameful. And particularly in light of their previous protestations of loyalty, of telling Jesus that he's wrong. And so people will make good decisions. Okay, I want to get the best doctrine I can get. I want to follow the truth as closely as I can. And then they will turn around and abandon that and go off and do something else. Well, how do they rationalize this in their mind? Do they convince themselves, well, I'm still following, I'm still looking for the best, when in fact the best is right there? I don't know how they do this. I don't know what their thinking is. But the reality is, in the last days, I mean, we just don't have that much time. And it is not like there are sound churches all over the place. So what one can get, they better get. The time is fleeting. But I've watched too many people with whom madness takes control. And they end up doing the time warp. And the reality is, you know, if you make the decision, okay, I'm going to do this. I want the best, soundest teaching I can get. And then you abandon that. Well, how do you get there mentally in your thinking? Something's happened. Something's snapped. Something's gone wrong at some point. Well, Mark mentions, again, his nudity twice to emphasize the shame of their actions. And nakedness has been seen as something undesirable since the fall and is something to be avoided. Genesis 3:10, now this is after the fall. It's the first time we see the concept of nakedness in a negative sense. Because before the fall, nakedness is used in a positive sense. The man and his wife were both naked and did nothing to make themselves ashamed. They were not ashamed of each other, and they were not ashamed of themselves. Well, in the context of marriage, that's the only place that this is appropriate. That place, nakedness, is appropriate. And only there. But in 3:10, we see it in a negative sense following the fall. The Lord God calls to Adam and says, where are you? And Adam says, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked. Now suddenly there's fear and trepidation attached to nakedness that was not there before. Adam had been naked since his creation. Why all of a sudden has this change occurred? And the change is due to the introduction of the sin nature and the failure to obey God's command. Sin had entered into the picture. So what happens that makes this change, this big change all of a sudden? And of course, Adam, he personifies exactly what believers do. They rationalize it away. Oh, I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself. And essentially the implication is, I heard you in the garden. This is kind of your fault a little bit. Kind of is. And if you don't get that part of it, then he completely shifts it to God at all, lays it all at his feet. The woman whom you gave me. I would have been fine without her, is the implication. And yet he was not fine without her. But now he wants to blame God for giving her to him. Well, this is the deal in marriage. Oh, I'm grateful. I want to marry you. I love you. You know, the courtship, phase and all that. Oh, you're wonderful. You get married. Oh, they're not so wonderful. They have a sin nature. Oh, but you got to marry them, warts and all. And you got to stick with it. And so Adam wants to blame God. Oh, it's the woman that you gave me. I would have been fine. I was doing fine, naming all those animals. That was fun. But Adam was lonely. And so, and that's a part of it. And so God solved that problem, and then Adam turns around and blames him for solving it. Well, they're naked, and also Revelation 3:17. Here we see it in the context of the church. These seven churches, of course, have multiple representations in terms of how you have to interpret them. Seven literal churches at the time of John. Seven types of churches that exist throughout history. Seven periods of the church age that have advanced. And yet these are not strictly chronological in that you can... Clearly, I think there's no way you can't make the case that the Philadelphia church and the Laodicean church are on the planet at the same time in the last days. Because the Philadelphia church has promised the pre-Daniel 70th week deliverance. So they've, to me, that promise, what does that mean if you're not even on the planet? It's designed to encourage those that are there. And again, where are the Laodiceans going to get that sound doctrine, that pure gold, if there are no churches doing it right? It argues for the existence of a church that's doing it right. That's the only place they could get it. Revelation 3:17 to the Laodiceans. Because you say, I am rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing. And you do not know that you are wretched and pitiable and poor and blind and naked. And that's an insult. You think you're clothed so finely, but yet spiritually you're naked. And also 16:15, which occurs in a sort of parenthetical passage in the midst of the Revelation, where Jesus just interjects a comment in all of this. And as you can see in 16:15, it should be enclosed in parenthesis. It is in the New American Standard. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake and keeps his clothes. This gets into prophetic orientation. Stays awake. Not just, God doesn't expect you to stay awake 24/7 because he's returning. Not physically awake, spiritually awake. Oriented to the prophecies. Oriented to your time in history. Blessed is the one who stays awake and keeps his clothes, so that he will not walk about naked, and men will not see his shame. The implication is certain people are going to appear at the Bema Seat in a state of what we would call spiritual nakedness and shame. And we were talking about this while we were on vacation. You know, how does this play out at the Bema Seat and going into the millennium and into the eternal state? Is this shame? Obviously, we see there's no, at the end of it all, going into the eternal state, certainly. No sorrow, pain, tears, or death, and all that. It doesn't specifically say no shame, however. But shame is a pretty negative emotion, as we know. It's not something that's a positive thing. And so, how does this play out? I mean, because he talks about it in 1 John. So some slink away in shame before him at his coming. And so, at the Bema Seat, how does this all play out? And how does this shame work into phase 3? And even if they're believers, you know, and they've totally tubed it. We find there in Corinthians, pastors that don't even do the job right, their work gets burned up. Well, I got to believe you've got to be pretty ashamed at the end of the day when that all happens. You have to stand there and admit, I was a failure phase 2. Well, at what point do you get over that and how? And that we're not ever really told. So does some of this follow people who abandon the truth and run off? Is this going to be reflected in their phase 3 experience? We're not told. But, I mean, if you've got shame at the Bema Seat, I mean, how are you going to just forget about that? I'm not ashamed anymore. Well, I don't know. So I don't want to find out. That's the big deal. I don't want to find out. And I would hope you don't either. Okay, well, our time is gone. Actually, whoops, we went a little over there. A good place to stop, so we will pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the great time you've given us off. We thank you for the provision of Bible doctrine so that we can continue to orient to your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.